Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 42, section 4, which is old single column, page 472. All right, so remember what appears to be a pretty short section. The previous section, section 3, took us a solid 2 hours to unpack. You know, this material, as we've seen, is all quite dense. They're building up. You'll see as we get into, you see there's a lot more, you know, prose in this section. You'll see they're going to build on a couple points they made in the previous. And every section is building. They're trying to get us in a mode where there's a subtle sequential suggestion going on. You know, no section really comes all out and tells you what they want you to recognize. They're playing very close to boundaries of what they can disclose and what they can't. And so, very much, you want to keep that in mind, that you're not only trying to figure out, you know, what's immediately there in the paragraph or the section, but in these instances, it's all the more important that you, the reflective discovery that's waiting for you is only when you see the line that's being subtly drawn through this. So, you know, you're wanting to look for, wait a minute, didn't they use that term before, you know, and go back and try to follow the threads. Okay, and as you can see by the title, they're wanting now to give us some quite definitive new perspective to attempt to contemplate phenomena that we have been studying for 100 years or more, to contemplate those, you know, familiar, quasi-familiar phenomena in a new perspective. And as we were mentioning last time, remember how we got into a much more generalized recognition at the end. We were talking about all those details of matter, but we got into a very definitive recognition of how you have to be aware of the whole, the wholeness of things. You'll see that's in the midst of some quite definitive physics. Is that wholeness. They've been giving you a lot of philosophic context. They're actually going to zero in a little bit more specifically on some initial physics in this section. And so you're wanting to have this new philosophic perspective in place when you go to try to rethink the physics. All right, let's get into it and see what they say.
4. Energy and matter transmutations. Light, heat, electricity, magnetism, chemism, energy, and matter are, in origin, nature, and destiny, one and the same thing, together with other material realities as yet undiscovered on Urantia.
Okay, so a little paragraph to give you the sweep. In what way, we've been stressing it, in what way are they one and the same thing? It's a universe of motion. Doesn't matter what the phenomenon is, what the activity is, it's a motion. Magnetism is a motion. Electricity is a motion. Heat is a motion. You know, chemism is a motion. To even use that not very oft used term, you know, as a parallel to magnetism, I mean, it's not much used because it kind of smacks of you know, mystery and mysticism that magnetism does, you know, and still holds for many people, and certainly held for people when they were first contemplating magnetism. You know, that ism on there, you know, has shades of, you know, opening for your spiritual consciousness to find mystical playgrounds, right? And so, you know, chemism, I mean, the chemical activity, bonding, you know, chemical reactions, to not think of that in such billiard ball terms, to recognize that there's some very holistic motion phenomenon that is a molecule. You know, it's not just atoms bonded together, glued together by some force, quote unquote. You know, we don't have any forces. We just have motion. There are no forces. Gravity's a motion. Electricity and magnetism are motions. And at the end there, and they together with other material realities as yet undiscovered on Urantia, the two imaginary forces that we've dreamt up, the weak force and the strong force, you know, don't actually exist, but there is a phenomenon that they are related to and that they're a rationalization of, the phenomenon we keep touching on, the whole subelectronic domain, you know, what is actually fundamentally giving the atom integrity, you know, and then hence all kinds of things related to the atom are involved in that phenomenon. You know, so when we study interactions of particles and we have to, you know, invoke the weak force or the strong force to rationalize this interaction, I see there's all of these subelectronic phenomena that we are not aware of as a literal fact that we are attempting to rationalize. And so they're just reminding all those things too. They're, you know, you now think you've discovered some of those things and you have names for them and whole, you know, physics constructs for them, like the, you know, weak force, strong force, that sort of stuff. Well, all that whole domain is also motion. Everything's a motion. Everything's a motion. And you know, and so just saying, you know, just think about how the difference between saying chemistry and chemism, it just allows for you to think of it as emotion more. Chemism sounds like some dynamic, the motion phenomenon. Yeah?
You know, I know everybody else gets this, but motion. I mean, how is, I understand what motion is, mm-hmm. you know, but how is something that is, you know, material, so to speak, how is it a motion versus being in motion?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, I mean, you probably answered this question a hundred times.
But
I just have a hard time, right. You know, maybe you can figure out a way to, you know, bring it down to my ninth grade level.
The easiest way to start contemplating how matter itself could be a motion. You know, that's obviously the starting point for making this transition from the current paradigm, which is a universe of matter that sometimes moves around.
It's in motion.
Yeah, that might be in motion, right? To a universe of motion, where there isn't really a separateness between matter and motion. Matter is a motion. When you say matter in motion, think about what you're thinking of. I mean, the first thing you're thinking of is, you know, it's like a baseball flying across the, you know, towards the batter, right? You've got this blob of matter that's in motion across space. You think of translational motion. But remember, you know, even when you're talking, when you're thinking in a billiard ball model fashion, I can do something besides throw that baseball and translate it across space. I could set it on a desk and spin it. You know, it could have rotational motion about an axis. Okay, and when it's in motion like that, when that mass is in motion, it's not getting away from me. It's still just right there. You know, it's not as different from the baseball just sitting there on the desk, apparently apparently static.
Even though it's in motion in different ways, it's right. In motion versus.
Right. See, so think about, you know, when we're talking about matter being a motion, it's not a translational motion; it's a rotational motion. It's a rotational motion, so it's localized, and it's an absenite rotational motion. So fundamentally, all these phenomena, when I say it's a universe of motion, it's a universe of absenite motions, open and closed, like motions. Motions that, you know, have an outwardness to them, and motions that, you know, are localized, wrapped back upon themselves in some way. And those motions are then have a projection down in the finite. When we see this object, like this cup, that seems to be this static thing, you know, what you're experiencing is the shadow cast down into the finite of a localized, you know, absenite rotational motion. It's a localized phenomenon in the absenite, and so it has a localized, you know, and sort of skin-like static shadow that it casts down into the finite. Okay. But you know, we discovered, you know, for 100 years ago, more, when you started to burrow down into that, you know, the details of the matter of that cup, it doesn't seem so static. You know, the first thing you discover is that it's molecules, and the molecules are jiggling around, and then you zero in on the molecule, and you find that there's all these atoms, and the atoms are jiggling around, and then you zero in on the details of the atom, and there's electrons, you know, in a whirl, and the fact that even from a billiard ball perspective, the more you zero in, the less static it seems, is a hint that fundamentally you have motions, and these things that seem to be in motion are the projections, the shadows that are these dynamic presences that we experience in the finite. So in order for an object to have a given mass, it has to have a certain amount of absenite motion. And the more that absenite motion it has, the more mass it has. And it's a localized motion, so the shadow that it casts, just it's like a mass right there. Right? Like I said, the easiest way to appreciate how it can be a motion is it's a motion that you can't see because it's in the absenite. And so you're just seeing this shadow that's cast, and it seems like it's not even a rotation, because if you have a rotation about an absenite axis, when you project that into the finite, remember the absenite is a transcendental space. You project that down into the finite, that one absenite axis doesn't project down into one finite axis. A given axis in the absenite projects into all directions in the finite.
How do you know this?
You know that because that's the logic of the relationship between a transcendental space and the finite space.
But can we experience absenite, which is, you know, part of the ultimate, or is it?
We can only experience the shadow, the finite right. Shadow that's cast.
Absolute,
yep.
Do you mean shadow literally?
No, of course I don't mean the shadow literally. I mean figuratively, in the same way that they speak of everything being projected, you know, and Jesus would use the old Greek shadow analogy, you know, play off of that. You know, not literally, you know, it's not literally. But it helps you to, you know, to use that analogy. It helps you to appreciate that it's more substantive the closer you get to the aisle, right? And so using that analogy of you have some substance in the absenite and a shadow in the finite, you know, has that aspect to it of thinking that seeking upward for the real substance. You know, when Jesus said, store your treasures in heaven and not on earth, He's reminding you. Don't think that what's, you know, the immediate finite things are the substance and everything else is wisps. You know, it's more substantive as you go more transcendent. The aisle's the most solid fact. So, you know, he was encouraging you to not, you know, if you, he's you know, and when he's, if you generalize what he's saying to a physicist, he's saying, don't try to rationalize the substantiveness, you know, the literalness of physical phenomena just totally within its finite expression. Seek a higher root to that for its substance. And when you think about a mass in motion, which is more substantive, the mass or its translational motion? Obviously, we call the mass the substance, and then the motion what the substance is doing. Okay, that motion is a vectorial phenomenon. Isn't that the proper word? I think so. You know, you express it by an arrow. But the mass is a scalar phenomenon. You don't express it by an arrow with a certain length, you know, for its magnitude. You know, so it has a magnitude and a direction. It's just a magnitude. That's because it's not, you know, fundamentally a finite phenomenon. It's an absonite phenomenon. So, you know, like I said, no absonite direction projects down into one finite direction. Projects into all.
Is that kind of why in the comment the material is a shadow of the spiritual? Is that what
I mean? Right. See, you know, like I said, when he tried to get you to think about the relationship between matter and spirit relative to your personality. Personality is spirit pattern, not energy pattern. So the immediate substance of personality is spirit. And so then figuratively, matter is a shadow, you know, relative to you personally. Spirit is more real immediately to the personality influence than matter is. Okay? But that doesn't mean that the Isle of Paradise is just a shadow cast by the body of the eternal sun. Yeah, it's not, don't think about it. Literally. I mean, for energy pattern, you know, matter is more substantive than spirit. You know, and you'd say it the other way around. Then from that perspective, spirit is a shadow, you know, relative to matter being a substance, relative to energy pattern. Right. Now, right, so it's only in the sense of personality that you can use that Greek, you know, that you can play off of Plato, like Jesus was, you know, and use that shadow idea.
Is that why you said earlier that matter has more substance the closer you get to paradise, it becomes more spiritual, because it is more spirit?
It's not because it's more spirit-like the closer you get to the aisle. Just, I mean, a simple way, when we think, right now, when we use the word substance.
What was the question?
Yeah, I was just trying to repeat it there briefly, I mean, for the people on the webinar. She was asking about, is it, when I said it was more substantive the closer you get to the aisle, is that because it's more spirit-like? You know, that idea of you can't tell the difference between matter and spirit when they're absolute expressions. No, I mean, that's not the way to think about it. It's, you know, think about when we're currently using the word substance in our universe of matter worldview, we call that which is static-like the substance, you know, and then it's in motion, what it's doing. You know, what's the most static-like matter in the universe of universes? The Isle of Paradise is the one stationary, you know, fact, right? See, so it's the most substance-like in that motionless fact that underlies, stands under, substance, right? That's standing under, right? I mean, that's why we coined that word. You know, see, so in that sense of, you know, there's all of this variability and fluffiness, but philosophically you're thinking, well, there's got to be something standing under it, you know, and then that's just a play upon that foundation, right? That's the substance concept, right? You know, and there literally is, you know, an absolute substance, an absolute fact that's standing under everything, the Isle of Paradise. And everything is in motion relative to it. Right? See, so it's the most literally substantial, substance-like, standing under, motionless-like. Okay? All right, so right, just think about everything as being a dynamic phenomenon. The reason this is important for your personality consciousness, it will help you to not fixate on the existential. The problem with the current physics model, where at the foundation of everything there's some little static nugget, is that's going to bias you even more towards existential, thinking that somehow it's all about being in that stasis of the existential. I am. No, one must do something as well as be something. Once you recognize that there are no static things, everything is a motion, you know, aside from the Isle of Paradise. And what you're wanting to do is be in a universe of motion. You need to be moving. You can't just be being.
Can't get away with couch potatoes.
You can't get away with just the initial relationship to God the Father. That static starting point. I mean, obviously a starting point is philosophically static. You know, boom, it begins. But once that instant is gone, you know, there is no stasis. You want to recognize, you want to bias, get yourself more balanced, get yourself biased away from that fixation on the existential and the Father. Balance the Father out with the Father's way, with the Mother. So that you can be a means for the Father's ends, right? If you're not in motion, you're of no use, okay? In a universe of motion. You would make a good, orange cone on the Isle of Paradise, but if you want to be something besides, you know, a marker on the Isle of Paradise, you know, here stands a motionless blob, then you need to strike step with the dynamic, right? You know, and as soon as you have the courage to recognize that there is no solid ground out here, you know, can't we just build a tent here and stay here forever, Master? This feels like motionless solid ground. No, that's an illusion, my children. Right? So we need to strike step with the fact of the universe, that it's in motion. There is no place that you can just be. That's an illusion. In order to be part of the cosmos, you have to be in motion, more and more in motion. To ascend is to be more and more dynamic. The closer you get to the aisle, the more in motion you are.
So those periods of rest may be periods where...
Right. The reason you have those periods of rest is because the pace is picking up, right? And until you can get comfortable with that dynamism, you know, it's like, okay, can I just pretend that it's motionless for a little while, right? Let me just close my eyes and pretend it's like when I was a little boy, you know, on Urantia, and it seemed like there was these static things that I could just sit on, all right, and try to get my bearings, you know? So they give you that luxury to pretend that it's motionless for a little bit, and then you have to open your eyes and I mean, the dynamism on Uversa, you know, or on a Havona world, you know, if you were exposed to it, you'd go instantly insane. I mean, it would be so dynamic, it would just completely fry your, you know, senses. There's no way, you know, you could keep up with it. Remember how they, you know, think about plugging into the universe circuits. Think there's a couple of voices in those circuits? You think that's pretty dynamic? You think a fire hose is big? Imagine plugging into that and to not have it scramble your consciousness.
How are you supposed to ease us into
that? Right. Right. You've got very huge buffers, you know, initially, filters. They give you a little tiny trickle. You know, it'll be a long time before you can plug right into the main line and hear, you know, 600 octillion voices simultaneously. Right? Right? All right, so that's, you know, it's a universe of motion. It's dynamic. And you need to have find the courage to let go of the white-knuckle grip on the little object, you know, in front of you. Have the courage to let go and start going with the flow. The truth has no static aspect to it whatsoever. Truth is pure dynamism. And you want to obey that truth, see? So you've got to let go, or you can't obey the truth. It takes courage to do that, to trust that there is stability in the midst of such dynamism. We'll actually kind of get to that as we get into this a little bit. A very surprising explanation of what we think must be the greatest static. You'll see when we get to it. All right, let's so that little paragraph is just to point out, see, in origin, nature, and destiny, right, in all ways, it's a motion. You can't seek refuge in the origin or the destiny points. If the nature part seems to be too, no, it's a motion from in beginning, middle, and end. It's nothing but motion. You know, the conjoint actor doesn't initiate a stasis and then kick it into motion. He initiates a motion, period. Okay.
We do not fully comprehend the almost endless changes to which physical energy may be subject. In one universe it appears as light, in another as light plus heat, in another as forms of energy unknown on Urantia. In untold millions of years, it may reappear as some form of restless, surging electrical energy or magnetic power, and still later on, it may again appear in a subsequent universe as some form of variable matter going through a series of metamorphoses to be followed by its outward physical disappearance in some great cataclysm of the realm. And then, after countless ages and almost endless wandering through numberless universes, again may this same energy reemerge and many times change its form and potential. And so do these transformations continue through successive ages and throughout countless realms. Thus, matter sweeps on, undergoing the transmutations of time, but swinging ever true to the circle of eternity. Even if long prevented from returning to its source, it is ever responsive thereto, and it ever proceeds in the path ordained by the infinite personality who sent it forth.
Okay, so they start out with a little poetry, you know, even, you know, using a little bit more of a poetic designation for the first source and center of all things. The capital I, capital P, infinite personality. You know, that's a you know, once designation to do that like that. So, you know, why would they do that? We're about to dive into details of, you know, little thingies doing this, that, and the other thing, you know, and it's not going to feel very personal. So they want to remind you up front, no, it is a direct expression of infinite personality. It couldn't be more personal. And the fact that you can't appreciate it as being an expression of a personality right now is just a reminder of how lowly your beginning is, right? That it seems like a dirt clod is a long ways away from, you know, the height of personality expression, okay? But it isn't. There's actually no distance between the two. And to begin to recognize matter as being intimate with personality, if you set it in motion fundamentally, it should be easier for you. One of the reasons it seems like it's so far away is because it seems, you know, that a personality is a dynamic phenomenon. But a dirt clod is very static. Right? But it's not. It couldn't be more dynamic. It's more dynamic than you could even imagine. Right? So it's not as far apart as you thought.
But it's not anthropomorphic.
But it's not, we're not talking animism. Right? Yeah. There, you know, it, but person, power personality synthesis is possible. Just think about it. Think about it initially, like they said it here, rather than putting God in the dirt clod, you know, which is, you know, basically animism. Okay, and think about it how they suggested. You got all of these doings, and it ever proceeds in the path ordained by the infinite personalities who sent it forth. Okay, in eternity, there's a will. Now, and that manifests down in time as this incredibly circuitous way. You know, think about what they were just, you know, suggesting you follow this, you know, energy as it just, you know, wanders all over the place and goes through every transformation you can think of, right? You know, it seems like a purposeless way. No, in eternity there is a will. Can you begin to imagine that infinite will could express that way? Well, if you remind yourself it's not a finite will, it's an infinite will. So if you express an infinite will in the finite, will it be a very simple expression? No, it'll probably be pretty darn complex and holistic. Will it leave any spot untouched? Any phase untouched? No. An infinite will would express every possible phase of energy in every location, in every direction, you know, at some time or other. Or you know, it would be, not wouldn't be infinite will. You know, it's going to fill the finite repletely. Right? That's what they're trying to get you to appreciate. Right? Our God is too small. In general. Humans' God is too small in general. You know, we think of a God that will just draw a line like that, and he's finished. It is finished. No, it's the infinite personality. The capital I, infinite, capital P, personality. He can't just draw a little line and say, it is finished. There is no such possibility. He draws all lines in every direction, of every color and every size, and all at the same time. That's the infinite personality's will. Okay, so I mean, you got the basics there. Just, you know, that's, you know, the main thing. Now, just note a couple little points. Towards the end there, when they say transmutations of time, but swinging ever true to the circle of eternity. The facts of time, in contrast to the truths of eternity. And how they try to get you to initially reflect on the contrast by thinking about the difference between a line and a circle. You know, when they're saying they're ever true to the circle of eternity, they don't mean going around the elliptical paths of the master universe. That's not what they're talking about. Okay, you know, they're trying to get you to recognize that. You know, you watch some physical phenomenon going along a line as a sequence of facts in time, but in some way, you know, that's a part of a circle in eternity. And the whole circle of eternity won't fit into time in any given spot, so it's a really big circle. You know, so it pretty much, you know, the tiny little bit of it that dips down at one point looks like a line. But it's actually a tiny little chunk of a great infinite circle. Okay? I mean, it's an infinite circle, so it literally looks like a stick straight line in the finite. Doesn't have any arc to it. Right? all the, you know, and then there's a line over there, and a line over there, and a line over there, and a line over there. There's all these lines all over the place, just all, seeming almost an infinite number of lines. Every one of those is a little dipping of the circle of eternity into the finite in different directions in different ways, all at the same time. One circle, many, you know, inserts into the finite as a little line, you know.
Is that why they say, you know, all time is present to God, you know, past,
future,
at the same time?
So it's right, yeah. They try to use those, yeah, try to get you to begin to contemplate, you know, eternity, you know, not future eternity, not, you know, experiential eternity, but existential eternity, you know. That's wholly there right now. And so think about that. Your little brief life on this world. That's a little bit of that circle. Dips into time and then pulls out. Right? You know, that you have a beginning and an end of that mortal self. You know, that mortal self is not eternal. You know, it isn't a circle. It's unto itself. It's the circle, briefly dipped, you know, and observable, and then it's out. Okay? And then the difference, you know, then the circle dips in a different way. And there's a Marantxa being for a stretch. And then that pulls out. And there is no Marantxa being, you know, anymore. And right? You're trying to get yourself to actually be part of the circle instead of a fleeting little line segment where the circle dips in and pulls out. Right? To become real is to wrap yourself around the circle, to synchronize with eternity. Right? You know, and you're given an initial thread of that by grace, that initial encirclement of the Holy Spirit. Okay? It is an initial measure of wrapped all the way around the eternity circle that you're given by grace. The rest of you, you know, is a little part of the circle that's going to pull out of view at some point. Which do you want to strike step with? Which do you want to build upon? I want to make more lines that disappear one day, or I want to add to the circular part of me. Okay? You know, again, where are you going to store your treasures? In the lines that evaporate, or in the circle that doesn't? Okay? Okay? That's what they're getting at. Try to identify with that which, you know, can strike step with an infinite circle of eternity, okay? So that it's real. All right, the one other little thing in there is a fun little hint about the physics of the structure of the nucleus of an atom. You know, we know that the nucleus of an atom has both an electric aspect and a magnetic aspect. Notice what they do in there, you know, a little bit towards the beginning of the paragraph, when they say surging electrical energy or magnetic power. Did they just not want to use the word energy twice? So they used power the second time? You know, of course not. What did we just learn when they, how they were using the word power? That power is the more literalized, mass-like fact than energy. All right. When you, this is something that you actually begin to recognize early on as you start to do what I've done and start to deduce the nature of the electronic motions that, that are material objects, like a nucleus, is that there's the electrical part is not so immediately related to the mass as the magnetic part. The magnetic part is more mass-like than the electric part. That's what they're alluding to there. You know, I didn't create a rationalization to rationalize that sentence. I just figured out some stuff and then one day noticed, oh, wait a minute, they're actually alluding to that fact right there, aren't they? You know, what I discovered logically, that the magnetic part is the more immediately mass-like motions Yeah, there's a system of motion that is one property of which is what we call mass.
Yeah. Isn't that how an electronic motor works? It creates a magnetism that engages the mass, that actually makes things move.
Yeah, right. He's for following the webinar. He's talking about a motor and thinking about how an electromagnetic motor, relates to the mass, and makes it move. Of course, in an atom, it's even more fundamental. Where I'll bring it out here because it comes up in a little bit. You have a three-dimensional space that you're doing all this motion stuff in. And the three fundamental phenomena that we currently rationalize as forces, that aren't made up, like the weak force and the strong force, are an electric force, a magnetic force, and a gravitational force. Those are the three forces that actually manifest out in space. You might notice that the weak and the strong one that they talk about, they tell you, well, those aren't actually manifestable. That should give you a clue that maybe they're not real. The three that you can experience, and they're probably real, there's three of them. You suppose it's a coincidence that there's three of them and it's a three-dimensional space? Of course it's not. An electric phenomenon, the electricity they were talking about there, that's a one-dimensional absonite phenomenon. The magnetism, that's a two-dimensional. And gravity is a three-dimensional. And even though they're one, two, and three-dimensional in the absonite, they all project as a three-dimensional thing in the finite. Right? But they're different kinds of three-dimensional things. Right? We notice that it's a different activity. It's a different manifestation. Okay, so they're actually hinting at that, trying to get you to this discovery of that one, two, three dimensionality, anyway. All right, let's keep going.
The power centers and their associates are much concerned in the work of transmuting the automaton into the circuits and revolutions of the electron. These unique beings control and compound power by their skillful manipulation of the basic units of materialized energy, the automatons. They are masters of energy as it circulates in this primitive state. In liaison with the physical controllers, they are able to effectively control and direct energy even after it has transmuted to the electrical level, the so-called electronic stage. But their range of action is enormously curtailed when electronically organized energy swings into the whirls of the atomic systems. Upon such materializations, these energies fall under the complete grasp of the drawing power of linear gravity.
Okay, this paragraph and then the next one. So a little preface to remind you up front that there's definitely a significant phenomenon in the universe of universes where the power beings are fundamentally involved in the process of taking a hold of automatons and doing something with them, all the way up, still quite significantly, as they're saying there, into the electronic level. But once you get to fully an atomic expression of this very complex system of motion, then not so much are they directly involved. Now, if you remember back in paper 29, the very important exception to that is, the way they say that, their action is enormously curtailed, right, when it gets to the atomic, but not, turned off. The primary exception is the primary associators. Now, that flavor of master physical controller that are called primary associators, they can still very definitively manipulate atoms. Yes. Remember, it's the primary associator that's the first, it's not a being technically, it's an entity, that comes to a world to begin the terraforming process. Okay, You know, they have to actually be able to manipulate atoms. They need to take atoms and they need to put them together into a circular loop of DNA. And they need to build a husk around that. They need to build the material construct of a prokaryote. You know, the little thing that's built in their image. A little power plant, like a power being. The life carriers come and animate it. You know, and then off these things go and start terraforming the planet. Right? He needs to be able to, you know, even do something as detailed as grab a hold of atoms and put them together into a loop of DNA. And a primary associator can do that. The other ones, they can't manipulate like that. Okay, so you know, that's a very important thing. The other thing in there, we spoke to a little bit. Notice how they gave you both a Latin perspective and a Greek perspective. In the middle, sort of in the middle there, when they say, in liaison with the physical controllers, they are able to effectively control and direct energy even after it is transmuted to the electrical level, the so-called electronic stage. I said Latin and Greek because the AL suffix is really more coming from the Latin and the IC suffix is more coming from the Greek. Okay, but in both cases, it's indicating that it's you have a likeness, you know, the AL and the IC suffixes. And especially when the so-called electronic stage, right? We're not just talking about electrons, but we're talking that which is like electrons, electronic, okay? That electronic level that we are always talking about, that's all of those fundamental particles, you know, like an electron is one of those fundamental particles, but not just the electron, as we've stressed. A proton, you know, is electronic. A photon is electronic. A neutrino is electronic. Okay, those basic particles where you have a system of 100 ultimatons and then you're augmenting that with some electronic level energy, the kind of energy that's like what you have augmenting an electron. Right. So that's why they're saying it that way. You know, and the AL suffix too means like, you know, electric like. All right. So there will be lots of things in the universe that didn't just get that way by themselves. Beings were intimately involved in getting. You know, what's a great example of a place where you can go and see lots and lots of atoms and molecules that didn't just, you know, assemble that way? Sun. That's a really definitive example of an artificially constructed place. Come on. Where are you going to go next in the next life? Architectural worlds, right? Right? There's a definitive example of a material construct, you know, where you've got all kinds of, you know, crystals and all the elements, you know, all 100 elements, and I mean, all this stuff, you know, did it just, you know, slowly accumulate? And no, I mean, the power beings went in there and took the ultimatons and put every ultimaton exactly in the place they wanted it, right? Built it from the ultimatonic level up, the entire world, you know, which might be as big as a sun. Yeah, when you mention sun, I mean, right? I mean, remember the basic order, you've got, like when you go to the local system headquarters, you've got the sub-satellites are about the size of the Earth, the primary satellites that are about the size of Jupiter, 10 times the diameter of the Earth, and Gerasim, 100 times the diameter of the Earth, size of the sun, right? So, you know, they make an object the size of the sun one ultimaton at a time. Now, they don't do it with tweezers. That would take too long. It's just in their presence, right? Things crystallize. The ultimatons obey their presence and crystallize into forms.
It kind of makes me wonder if the power directors or something like that has something to do with the pyramids.
You know, that idea of, you know, did power beings have something to do with some of the mysterious material constructs on the earth that we like to endow with lots of mystery. They seem to be kind of mysterious. You probably need some word with an ISM at the end, you know, if you're going to talk about them. It's those sorts of constructs, if they aren't just the ingenuity of andites, right? There may be some constructs that are even more mysterious than what andites had the ingenuity for. Remember, you had all kinds of secondary midwares, you know, bored, doing lots of things for lots of centuries. And they are like mini power beings. Remember how we talked about that when we were talking about the power beings? You know, they have a little bit of ability to do that power being like direct engagement of matter and, you know, manipulate it. So, you know, you want to always kind of keep that in mind, that there might be, you know, archaeological megalithic things that you would find that seem awfully mysterious, even for andites, is the explanation. You know, and it might be secondary midwares that were behind that. You know, did they need to get a crowbar to roll the stone? You know, no. They can just engage it and do like a power being with it and move it. You know, so if you're bored, you know, who knows what you would do. All right. Okay, so that basic fact, and just reminding you that, but this came up with, I guess this was last time, someone asked me a question, and I said, we'll get to that. It was this paragraph, I can't remember who asked me that. I think it was someone on the webinar, that's right, it was someone on the webinar asked me, they were wondering about how, if, you know, what, if power beings, you know, how their relationship was to these things. And, you know, here they're trying to remind you, by and large, the power beings are not dealing with matter as we know it. They're dealing with the sub-electronic domain. Except for the few exceptions, you know. But in general, don't be looking for molecular atomic, you know, assemblages that a power being is behind. You know, you're going to be looking for things you can't currently measure or see, the sub-electronic stuff. You know, their energy grid through the galaxy and stuff is all sub-electronic. You know, so we wouldn't even know it's there right now. Right. Okay. So that's, you know, that's why they're giving all that detail right there. Then the last little footnote they add to that.
Gravity acts positively on the power lanes and energy channels of the power centers and the physical controllers, but these beings have only a negative relation to gravity, the exercise of their anti-gravity endowments.
Okay, see, so once things get fully to the power manifestation, you know, atomic and molecular, like they said, they're basically not directly engaging that and manipulating it. If they want to have an influence upon that power phenomenon, that massified phenomenon, to coin a word, I guess, they have to do it indirectly. Gravity is the ruler of that domain. And they can't do gravity-like, but they can have an anti-gravity presence. They could say, let's temper a little bit what gravity would do here, and indirectly we'll get what we're looking for. But they can't just directly do it. You know, they're subservient to gravity. But they're not totally without their ability to still function. They just have to do it indirectly. You know, so if they want a solar system to have a certain arrangement of planets, certain planets being certain distances from the sun, you know, they can regulate their anti-gravity presence. You know, they pose a little bit more anti-gravity presence. There's going to be a little less inward gravity from that star. Things will spread out, you know. They have some control, and then it's not just in the macroscopic, they're going to use gravity going forward here in the paper, talking about the microscopic too, which current science would say is silly, that that the thing we call gravity right now in science has anything to do with the structure of an atom. You know, they'll say gravity is way too weak. Those masses are way too small. You know, you can't think of the electrons as being gravitationally in orbit about a nucleus. There's not enough gravity for that. Okay? But the relativists use the word gravity in those contexts. What do they mean? They mean there is an inward phenomenon. Remember how this story started. The foundation of everything is the outward motion that is the force charge of space. That's the starting point. And anything that is going to be experienceable is going to be relative to that outward starting point. It's going to have a relative inwardness to it. Everything is an inwardness, you know. So fundamentally, you know, for an atom to be right there in front of me just at that spot at this time, see, there has to be some sort of inwardness imposed upon the background, which would want the automatons it's composed of to go off at the speed of light in every direction. Right? So everything, so just, that's what, when you see gravity, think inward in contrast to the starting point of outward. That's the fundamental philosophic sense that they're trying to play with, is that all the phenomena that we observe are an inwardness in one way or another. All of these things, light, heat, electricity, magnetism, chemism, energy, and matter, are all some sort of an inward motion relative to the starting point of outwardness. I mean, even though the velocity, the speed of light, like a photon, is, okay, that's outward, but the photon itself, right, is there. Now, it's not everywhere in the force charge. Right? There's some sort of a beginning inwardness there. Not enough inwardness that it can move independent of the starting point velocity or speed, the speed of light. But eventually it gets built up where enough where the object actually has a mass and then it isn't moving at the speed of light. So it has enough inwardness to break free from just being a marker dot on the force charge and being outward. Right, so that's it's in that more fundamental sense that they might be doing something microscopic too, but it's going to be not directly. It's not going to be, they're not going to be doing, I want to do more inward likeness right here. They can't do that. I could temper the inwardness there and indirectly get what I'm looking for. I could impose a little diminishment of the centering influence. You know, that's the kind of anti-gravity we're talking about, not Newtonian gravity, not linear gravity. It's not anti-linear gravity. Remember, it's anti-centering influence, anti-absolute gravity, you know, that we're talking about. You know? So if you don't want that atom to be quite so centrally influenced, you could, you know, loosen the bonds on it a little bit. You know, like, let's say you wanted to make Maranja substance out of atoms. What if you wanted to loosen them up a little bit so you could weave spirit substance into them and make Maranja substance? Remember, it takes power beings and Maranja power supervisors to make Maranja substance because the power beings have to loosen it up, pose a little anti-gravity on it, open it up, and then the Maranja power supervisors thread some spirit substance into it and make 100 Maranja atoms. See, that's an example of using that, you know, that anti-gravity influence to have it not be so closed and, you know, no room for anything else here. Right? It's a very tight little inward system. Right? Yeah, let's loosen you up a little bit. Right? So if the power beings weren't, you know, you're going around the universe as a Maranja, with a Maranja body. If there isn't a, you know, if there isn't that loosening, it clamped down and squirt all the spirit substance out, and then where would you be? Right?
Back at the resurrection hall.
Maranja substance is artificially made and maintained. It's, you know, it's an artificial substance. It's an art form in both its initiation and its ongoingness.
So even as we evolve, you know, into spirit form and into the core finality eventually, mm-hmm. whatever, how long it takes. And we become, you know, consciously aware of these things happening, so to speak, and we study it, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We still, as you know, finite mortals, even if we get to be eternal mortals, we don't really able to ever do this kind of stuff, right? This is something that we observe being done by other types of beings, correct?
Yeah, as far as we know, so for those in the webinar, he's just wondering if we ever do any of this sort of stuff. And it certainly seems that by and large, during the finite age, we wouldn't be in any sort of definitive way doing this stuff. But in the absentite age, you know, who knows? Remember, I mean, what's the nucleus of the absentite age from our perspective? The power personality synthesis. Why does a secondary midwayer have a little bit of power being like manifestation? Because they're more of a manifestation coming from the Supreme Being than they are a manifestation coming from the Infinite Spirit. They're a little bit more of a power personality synthesis by nature than just a personality. And it's like, well, how would I have the ability to do something definitively energy-like? You know, as much as your thought adjuster is pure spirit, it's pure energy. You know, and they tell you a point in the book that in the absentite age, that pure energy part of your thought adjuster will be, you know, manifest. I mean, you're going to be manifesting as a power personality synthesis, both sides of your adjuster, if you will, at the same time, rather than just the spirit side, basically, right now. Right? So who knows what you might be able to do?
So when they're able to manipulate these energies in, far ages of light and light on a planet, in a planet where they say,
the power beings in the fifth stage of light and life.
They're not really doing it, right? I mean, the human beings.
The human beings aren't doing it, no. It's the power beings, that take a hold of the world in the fifth stage of light and life and, you know, basically make an architectural world out of it.
Because they say something, you know, even if you get to the point of where you can, you know, basically kind of, change one atom into another, or one substance into another, kind of like on a replicator on Star Trek or something. Even if you get to that point, but that's not really doing it yourself, right?
Right. I mean, okay. That was describing, you know, that being able to, you know, manipulate things even down to the ultimatonic level. That's kind of describing that second paragraph in the section here. I mean, you know, at some point, humans can do all kinds of manipulations, but they can't grab a hold of puissant energy and make ultimatons. You know, and that's the punchline of that passage you're remembering there. You know, neither can we make a collection of molecules and through us life animation gets bestowed upon it. You know, those are the two things they point out. You're never going to be able to make ultimatons or, you know, bestow life animation. But you'll be able to take, you know, stuff and manipulate it endlessly, you know, that life animation is engaged to. You'll do all kinds of genetic engineering. But you can't start anything from scratch. Okay, let's get some more here. So, okay, and just before you read, so now we're going to transition away from the power beings mostly and their doings.
Throughout all space, cold and other influences are at work creatively organizing automatons into electrons. Heat is the measurement of electronic activity, while cold merely signifies absence of heat. Comparative energy rest. The status of the universal force charge of space provided neither emergent energy nor organized matter were present and responding to gravity.
Right. Okay. You know, it's a hypothetical. Provided they were. Right. Anyway. okay. So, you know, so now we're going to get into, you know, the main interest to physicists is not the constructs of power beings, you know, which, you know, you can't put their activity in your equations. I mean, okay, what about if there aren't power beings? You still have the case that you can start with automatons, and of their own nature and the environment that they're in, this stuff assembles into collections of 100, into atoms, into molecules, into stars. Okay, you don't need power beings, you know, to do this. They can do it, but they only do it in, you know, select instances. Most of the materialization is just a natural process. It's not an art form, if you will. However, notice how they described it. Throughout all space, cold and other influences are at work creatively organizing, right? I mean, it may seem like there's no personality immediately grabbing a hold of automatons, manipulating, like it is when you actually see a power being playing with stuff, okay? But the universe is mind-made and personality-managed in toto, not just in part, you know? So, you know, that's, remember, they reminded you, if you have to, go all the way up to the top, you know, behind it all is an infinite personality, you know? Out in the remotes of an outer space level, if two automatons come together, that isn't their will. Ultimately, it's someone's will, right? And if close examination shows no sign of personality activity, then it must be a very transcendent personality that's behind it. And you're just seeing a very impersonal shadow cast into time, right? So, it's always, you know, mind-made and personality-managed, you know? It's not like Lucifer declared in the first principle of the manifesto, that all of this happens and you drop the word creatively out of the sentence, you know, that there is no purpose. You know, influencers are just at work organizing automatons into electrons, Lucifer said. There's no creatively there. That's your wishful thinking, okay? That the word creatively, that adverb creatively is in there. That's the first principle. Okay? You know, and he's, you know, looking at it and going, there's no personalities here. Yeah, there's these beings that can play with this stuff. But out there in the first outer space level, that stuff is just doing that. That's just natural that it organizes. It's self-organizing. That's what current scientists believe. That matter is self-organizing. Okay, well, just reflect on that. Does that make sense? That chaos would produce order? You know? The chaos inherent in chaos is order, so that chaos can self-order itself?
Sets up how it orders to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Right. Where's the pattern? Yeah, right. And where's the, you know, I mean, not only, you know, you've got two questions. There's obviously a pattern, and then the influence that directs it towards that pattern, you know, and neither of those can be matter itself. Right? Mind made and personality managed. Mind made, there's an influence. Personality managed, there's a pattern. Okay. Right. So it's not self-patterning, it's not self-arranging, you know. But it appears to be when you just focus in on the local phenomenon. Okay, but have more relationship to truth than Lucifer did. Just because you can't see the personality doesn't mean that there isn't a personality. Logically, there has to be. It's illogical for magic for matter to be self-organizing. That would be magical matter, right? But for him, that didn't, you know, he didn't feel a dissonance with that. It's like, well, I don't think that's magical. That seems totally fine to me, just like it does to certain current scientists. Why couldn't matter organize itself? Because that's illogical. That doesn't make sense. All right, so, okay, let's get back to the physics. So, throughout all space, cold and other influences, okay? So instead of power beings, it's going to be cold and other influences that are going to bring this together. What do they mean by cold? Well, heat is the measurement of electronic activity, while cold merely signifies absence of heat. Comparative energy rest, you know, the absence of heat is comparative energy rest. It's like, well, okay, that seems fine. And then they say the status of the universal force charge of space. So what is cold? The force charge of space. which is a motion. So how, is that what you thought? When you think cold, you think, I'm warm, I'm still jiggling, I'm getting colder, I'm not jiggling as much, I'm freezing, I'm solid, I'm motionless, I'm cold. No. The colder you get, in the sense of the Urantia book, the more it is just that pure, smooth, outward scalar motion of the force charge of space. That's what cold is. So heat is any inwardness relative to that starting point. Heat is an activity, but see, it's in contrast to the outward. It's inward. So the more inwardness there is, so like they're saying there, the cold of the cold would be the status of the universal force charge of space, provided neither emergent energy nor organized matter were present in responding to gravity, provided there was no inward stuff going on, which would sully the purity of the outwardness, right?
So unpervaded space is really cold.
Hot and cold have no definition in unpervaded space because there's no force charge there. That's what pervaded means. See, pervaded allows, the force charge allows for the definition of hot and cold. Those words have no meaning in unpervaded space.
But unpervaded space is space.
It's space.
It's just and empty.
Right. But
it's not necessarily hot or cold.
Right, it's not hot or cold. Those words have no way to have a meaning in unpervaded space.
It's not one or the other.
I mean, they certainly, you certainly can't use hot and cold in the way we use it, where it would be, unpervaded space would be cold if the billiard balls weren't flying around very fast, if their velocities were low, and there's no billiard balls there. And it's not even hot and cold in this sense, because there's no force charge, there's no contrast to the force charge, there's nothing there.
Temperature is it at on our satellites?
We'll get to this. It gets quite cold when you get out. They're about to talk about that. You'll see in a second. Okay, so that's the way they're using. They're using heat is activity in contrast to the outward motion. Any sort of inwardness, and the more inwardness stuff there is, the more hotter it is. The more material-like active it is. The more of that motion stuff that they were talking about, light, heat, electricity, magnetism, chemism, all that, all that dynamism, is in contrast not to stasis, but to that foundational motion. That's the starting point. Okay, all right, so then the next paragraph there.
Gravity presence and action is what prevents the appearance of the theoretical absolute zero, for interstellar space does not have the temperature of absolute zero. Throughout all organized space, there are gravity-responding energy currents, power circuits, and ultimatonic activities, as well as organizing electronic energies. Practically speaking, space is not empty. Even the atmosphere of Urantia thins out increasingly until, at about 3,000 miles, it begins to shade off into the average space matter in this section of the universe. The most nearly empty space known in Nebadon would yield about 100 ultimatons, the equivalent of one electron in each cubic inch. Such scarcity of matter is regarded as practically empty space.
Okay, so let's start in the middle and off your question there. Fun little tidbit they throw in there. So, think about it. It's warm in this room.
Oh, yeah?
We're still able to move. It isn't super cold in this room. As you move up in the atmosphere, forgetting about things like local heating, and stuff, but just in general, as you go out, it's getting colder and colder and colder. Forget about ozone layers, warming and stuff like that. But just in general, just think about how, basically the phenomenon is the farther you get out, the colder it gets. Until you're way up in the exosphere, that outer, very tenuous part of the atmosphere. Above the thermosphere, when it's, you know, it's getting less and less dense, you know, more and more rarefied, and the kinetic energy of those billiard balls is, you know, slower and slower and slower, you know, it's getting colder and colder, heading towards absolute zero. Okay, and then they throw in there a fun little fact, that, you know, not when you get sort of maybe way out to the really tail of what we call the exosphere, but kind of like halfway there or so, at about 3,000 miles, they say it begins to shade off into the average space matter in this section of the universe. In other words, if you go outside of the cocoon that the master physical controllers have built around this solar system, it's a little bit more active out there than it is in here. You can actually go farther down the tail in here. See, so they're giving you a little hint about what kind of it's like out there. It's like, well, think about 3,000 miles out. That's kind of like what it's like out there. Now, that's a fun little clue that they're throwing in there. But, you know, you can find very remote patches of Orvieton or Nebadon, as they point out here, where, you know, there's almost nothing there. It's, you know, it's like you've got one particle per cubic inch. Right? I mean, how many particles do I have between my hands here? If I put my hands up in front of me, you know, the gas molecules that are between my hands here, you know, about basketball sized or so, 10 to the 23, right? 10 to the 23 molecules. It's a lot of zeros. Imagine if there's only one in a cubic inch, okay? The contrast, okay? You know, we can't get, you know, anywhere near such things in the hardest vacuums we can make in the lab, right? Not even close. Can you evacuate something in a lab, you know, to that kind of a density? And we mentioned that before back in paper 41, you know, so you get out there in, you know, in outer space, or not even outer space levels, but just out in the interstellar space, you know, and there's some very, very tenuous regions where a molecule or an atom can be sitting there doing its thing, and it never has to worry about another one bumping into it and goofing up what it's up to, okay? It's got tons of time to do some leisurely process that it would like to do that it never has time to do when it's being hit by 10 to the 23 molecules every second, right?
My follow-up question with that, being out there in the cold space.
Yeah.
We're closer to the sun if we're out there. Why aren't we warmer?
Well, again, I mean, remember, you know, when we think of hot and cold, you know, we're thinking about the atmosphere. I mean, you feel warm because molecules are slamming against your skin, and, you know, and that kinetic energy is being turned into heat. You know, just like if you bounce a ball a whole bunch of times, the ball starts to get warm, right? I mean, that's why you feel warm, is because those molecules are slamming into you at pretty high velocity and depositing some of that kinetic energy into heat in your body. Okay, you go out in space, I mean, you know, just get out in space a little ways away from the Earth, and there's not enough molecules hitting you for you to be, you know, hot or cold. You know, then it's just purely the side of you that the photons are hitting from the sun. Those photons hit you and deposit heat. But the, you know, the side that's in the shadow is not getting any photons, and it's, you know, at almost absolute zero, frozen solid. Right? See, there's no molecules to conduct the heat around to the back side. You know, I can put a heater in front of me here, a little space heater, and it'll make these molecules jiggle faster here, but those bump other molecules, and you know, it makes the ones behind me jiggle faster too, because it, you know, it diffuses through the room. There's no molecules to get the heat around to my backside out in space. And, you know, stand on the moon, and the only side that's getting any energy is the sun side. Okay. So let's see here. We got to keep going. We're going to run out of time here. Let's see. All right. So that amazing thought that what we call, you know, we have this idea of absolute zero, right? The coldest of the cold, you know, the you know, the idea of total motionlessness. I mean, that's the way we define absolute zero, you know, is that point when there is no more motion. But actually, absolute zero is the pure starting motion. It's the force charge of space.
Yeah. Got a question for Roger. What does the appearance of mean rather than just stating prevents the theoretical absolute zero?
I was just going to get to that. I mean, so, you know, theoretically, you could have a region of pervaded space that had nothing but the force charge. And technically, that region of space would be at absolute zero. But, that doesn't happen. There's always some. I mean, even in the most tenuous place, you've got 100 ultimatons in a cubic inch, and all the inwardness involved in them, you know, it's not pure outwardness no matter where you go. Right? So you're never going to have that pure outwardness appear, a manifest. You know, it's just a theoretical.
In the, what about in the other side of the hourglass?
Well, again, we were just talking about the reservoirs, you know, there's no force charge there.
They're unpervaded.
They're unpervaded. But, you know. Now, if you go way out in the fourth outer space level, okay, you know, there's, you know, going to be some very smooth space out there, right? Nothing is going on. I mean, there's nothing going on in the second outer space level. So, you know, the only stuff that's going on out there is stuff that's leaking from the first and second outer space levels, you know, out into there, you know, ultimatons that are, you know, straying out there and stuff. But, the, you know, there's no whirls out there or anything. They're beginning to detect, you know, the motion around in the third, but not because they're watching whirls, but I was just explaining. I mean, you know, you can send solitary messengers out there, and they can watch, you know, a stray ultimaton going through the third outer space level and going, wait a minute, I can see that puppy drifting a little bit. All right? I'm starting to see there's, you know, you need a marker dot in order to begin to see that drift. And so it's just that they're beginning to, but they haven't started up anything. I mean,
but I'm at the second.
The second is, you know, more than half built.
Because you said nothing in the second a minute ago. You meant third.
I meant nothing in the third. Yeah, nothing in the third and the fourth. If I said second, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Second.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's see. All right. So again, you see, you know, throughout all organized space, there are gravity responding. Like I said, there's all of this inward phenomena. That's what they're wanting you to think about. Okay, keep going.
Temperature, heat, and cold is secondary only to gravity in the realms of energy and matter evolution. Automatons are humbly obedient to temperature extremes. Low temperatures favor certain forms of electronic construction and atomic assembly, while high temperatures facilitate all sorts of atomic breakup and material disintegration.
Okay. All right, so now we're going to apply this idea. This is how we're going to use heat and cold. And, you know, we've been kind of talking about this already. So the fundamental thing that we want to think about in terms of what's the difference of heat and cold, what's the difference of the environment that the thing that you're interested in is experiencing? Is there a lot of sub-electronic activity in the environment of that thing, that atom, say? Or is there not very much? Okay. If you see low temperatures, you know, not a lot of sub-electronic activity, favor certain forms of electronic construction and atomic assembly. Yeah. If you don't have a very active environment, things can slowly, delicately assemble together and build up into bigger and bigger constructs. Okay. But high temperatures facilitate all sorts of atomic breakup and material disintegration. Well, back in 41, we talked about that a lot. We did a little bit here in this paper, too. You know, material disintegration, unraveling these structures. You put one of these structures down in the very dynamic environment of a star, all of that sub-electronic activity, see, which is even more fundamentally important than the atomic activity that might make it hot. The sub-electronic activity that makes it hot, you know, is going to impact the integrity of the atom in a more fundamental way, because fundamentally its integrity is sub-electronic. So if it's being assailed by all kinds of sub-electronic activity, if it's hot sub-electronically, these things are going to unravel.
Maybe that's a way to measure sub-electronic.
Well, we're just about to get to that sort of thing, yes. right, and the other thing, atomic breakup. Why did they say both atomic breakup and material disintegration? I mean, you know, doesn't material disintegration cover atomic breakup? Yeah. Yes. So why are they? Well, there's another way that things come apart besides down in the center of a star. If I have a glob of uranium ore in my hand, the uranium atoms in there are coming apart. There's atomic breakup of those atoms. And that, my hand and that rock are not in the inside of a star. Okay? So there could be high temperatures. Okay? Remember what we had in the previous thing about, you know, number 9 in the previous section about radioactive matter, right? We're about to pick that up again here. Right? Keep that in mind that this is something we want to understand a little bit more. The interior of the sun thing is kind of the paper 41 stuff that we were talking about. What about radioactivity? How do we understand radioactivity?
You said that in class before about the fact that uranium in some maybe other worlds may not break up.
Right, we'll get to that. Right. All right. Okay, so that's why they had the contrast there, to remind you of there's two different ways you could have things coming apart. Okay, keep going.
When subjected to the heat and pressure of certain internal solar states, all but the most primitive associations of matter may be broken up. Heat can thus largely overcome gravity stability. But no known solar heat or pressure can convert ultramatons back into puissant energy.
Okay, so so they're going to remind you of that. We've kind of already gone through that. Remember, at the very core, you're literally unraveling the collections of 100 ultramatons, you know, that electronic boiling point, right? But, you know, outside of that very core, there's so much activity that any sort of a big atom is being unraveled down to a small atom. I mean, everything is being leveled, you know, to the very smallest, most integrous atoms inside that star by all of this sub-electronic level activity, not to mention the electronic level activity too. But, you know, no finite process, nothing can be so hot as to unravel an ultramaton back into puissant energy, because that would mean you had a finite process that could do an absinthe thing, and that's illogical, right? you can't definitize that phenomenon with a finite process. It's going to take a transfinite being to definitize that process. So, you can never be that hot. And see, just again, the way they're saying that, heat can thus largely overcome gravity stability. Don't think so much of Newtonian linear gravity of the star. Think in a more fundamental sense. You can undo the inwardness and get it all back almost totally to outwardness, you know, where these ultramatons have this minimum inwardness. They're basically just this tiny little marker dot on the force charge, and they're outward. And they want to just go out. They're not going to be sitting there in a blob called a star. Right? They're going to go off into the, you know, the far corners of the universe of universes. Okay.
The blazing suns can transform matter into various forms of energy, but the dark worlds and all outer space can slow down electronic and automatonic activity to the point of converting these energies into the matter of the realms. Certain electronic associations of a close nature, as well as many of the basic associations of nuclear matter, are formed in the exceedingly low temperatures of open space, being later augmented by association with larger accretions of materializing energy.
Okay, so see the contrast. In number 10 in the previous section, they may mention collapsed matter and how you can have all kinds of slowing down phenomena with dark islands. Setting that aside, their main point there, and all outer space, all cold regions. So, and then at the end there, scientists recognize that there's kind of two sets of atoms. There's the really small ones that seem to have a bit of separateness from all of the bigger ones in terms of their origin. They can sense that there's some origin difference. And they've rationalized that. They've rationalized that all the little ones were made in the Big Bang. And then all the bigger ones were made inside of stars, and the biggest ones were made in supernovas. Okay? No. Okay? What do they say here? So all of, starting with ultramatons, getting up to collections of 100 ultramatons, making all of the smaller atoms, probably a lot bigger ones than they think are made in the Big Bang, but all of the smaller ones, I mean, they just think the first five, at most, were made in the Big Bang, up to boron. They're pointing out all of the smaller ones they just slowly, build themselves out in the cold regions of space. Okay, and then you need some more environmental influence to build up the bigger ones, and we don't want to get into that physics, but that's related to a phenomenon that they mentioned back in one of the very first papers, like paper 3 or something like that, when they're talking about an energy that you haven't quite recognized yet, but you have some inklings of. Okay, when you begin to understand the nature of particle physics in a true fashion, you discover there's a particular electronic level particle that's very involved in the construction of bigger atoms that helps to add those magnetic-like motions that add to the mass of an atom. Okay, and see, when they say, but being later augmented by association with larger accretions of materializing energy, so you get it in a domain where there's a flux of these particles, and their energy gets incorporated into the structure, and you build bigger and bigger ones until you get all the way up to 100. Okay? So, there is kind of two different sets, but it's not the Big Bang and supernovas. Yeah. It's what they're describing here.
Throughout a lot of time when I was in Utah, you really opened my eyes up to how science and religion have worked together to really have true science, true religion,
right.
Philosophy. And I don't know, this is kind of like after being told it and listening. And then going through all of these little, so revelational, insightful things, it just really drove home for me how you can never have any of that be true, and all these made up things, the Big Bang of without in a godless world. If you don't have that, you will never get there. We will eventually on this planet, but it just drove that home.
Right. See, when you don't have, a very subtle creative influence imposed upon every square inch of you know, every cubic inch of space, like there actually is, you're going to have to dream up all kinds of magical things to substitutes, big bangs and dark energies and, you know, and...
7 days.
Well, I mean, you know, if God created everything in 7 days, at least there's a creator. You know, a magic man is a lot better than magic matter. At least it's causal. I mean, magic matter is acausal. A magic man is at least causal. You know, it's quasi-logical. So you've got, you know, this is the fundamental way that atoms are built. Suns unravel them. Space builds them. I mean, obviously there's some overlaps and stuff, you know, but I mean, you can have fusion in a star, and you can have hydrogens being made into helium and this sort of stuff, yes. But the primary mechanism, you know, and all of this is stuff the current science doesn't have any concept of, right? Because it's all rooted in ultimatons and sub-electronic physics that science knows nothing of, right? You know,
is that because the temperature involved, that you talked about earlier?
Right, so in the cold space, there's so little sub-electronic activity that all this delicate stuff can happen without getting whacked. You know?
And so vice versa in the sun.
It's the opposite in the sun. You know, there's all kinds of whacking and it comes apart. Yep.
That's why I said earlier that other than gravity, temperature is the main.
Yep.
Is whack a technical term?
Whack is a technical term. All right.
It's an industry toy.
Okay. So that's I think that's all we need there. Go ahead.
Throughout all of this never-ending metamorphosis of energy and matter, we must reckon with the influence of gravity pressure and with the anti-gravity behavior of the ultimatonic energies under certain conditions of temperature, velocity, and revolution. Temperature, energy currents, distance, and the presence of the living force organizers and the power directors also have a bearing on all transmutation phenomena of energy and matter.
Okay, before we step through some of those things, I did notice there was one little thing I wanted to comment on the previous one. When they say, and all outer space can slow down electronic and ultimatonic activity. Again, you know, when you hear them say that in so many places in the book, understand, is, you know, the fast we're talking about is the outward motion. See, and anything that's inward gives you a net slowing down. Yeah, like I pointed out last time, if you're going to have something that appears to be the universe of matter, this static, you know, blob of mass that is this cup sitting in front of you, it's not imploding or exploding. You know, it's just sitting there, stasis-like. How do you create that illusion that it's not a universe of motion, that it's a universe of static matter blobs? You have to have enough inwardness, you know, to cancel the outwardness so that the net is, you know, seems to be stationary. Okay? So, you know... The localization of matter is a very dynamic phenomenon. It isn't like taking styrofoam balls and toothpicks, you know, and just gluing it there, you know, together, and there it sits. It's this incredibly dynamic phenomenon where it's going inward and outward very, very fast, simultaneously. Right? You know, there's nothing, you know, Isle of Paradise stasis-like about it at all. You know, the couch or chair you're sitting on is in frenetic activity. Right? All right, and then this, so they're talking about all this metamorphosis. We must reckon with the influence of gravity pressure and with the anti-gravity behavior of the ultimatonic energies. Okay? The gravity pressure, they just mentioned that in the previous section. Radioactive matter, they said, the disorganizing tendency and activity of the heavier elements under conditions of moderate heat and diminished gravity pressure. So when they say gravity pressure again, they're reminding you of that. They're subtly trying to get you to focus in on radioactivity and reflect on this. And like I mentioned back there, see, when they say moderate heat, so if there's subelectronic activity of a moderate nature, that might be have enough oomph to break delicate structures. Yeah, especially if you don't have some sort of a context that this structure, this atom is in, that's kind of clamping down on it. If you have diminished gravity pressure, if you have diminished inwardness of the environment, it's all the more possible that a little bit of activity could negate the inwardness, and things would start flying apart. Right? You know, a radioactive phenomenon is it's sitting there, and all of a sudden, you know, an alpha particle goes flying out of it, or an electron goes flying out of it. Right? It starts flying apart, literally. You know, that electron might go sailing off at almost the speed of light. It's flying apart. And you negate a little bit of the inwardness, and things go outward. Okay. All right. So that atomic breakup, that radioactivity, they're starting to focus in on this, and they're saying that, you know, fundamentally, and to have an outwardness is because there's inherent in automaton. One of the aspects of an automaton is this anti-gravity, this not inward aspect of it. I mean, it obviously has some inwardness because it's an automaton that's localized at a certain point. Okay, but it has a property where it can lead to the manifestation of outwardness in contrast to some structural inwardness. Okay, and there's the things that they mention about that. You know, if you might get some of this flying apart being manifest under certain conditions of temperature, velocity, and revolution. Okay, the temperature part, we've been pointing out. Fundamentally, if an atom's going to break apart, it's because it's being whacked by subelectronic activity. You know, something is doing work on it and breaking the quote-unquote bonds that bind it. Something's negating some of its inwardness and letting, someone's opening a door and letting something escape out the open door. Okay? So, that's definitely involved. The other two things, velocity and revolution. The velocity is you have these rotational motions. You have bigger and bigger quantities of this rotational motion as you get bigger and bigger nuclei of atoms. So it's a function of velocity. You get up to high enough magnitudes of rotational velocity, get up to big enough atomic nuclei, and they're getting that's getting fragile, and the environment might be hot enough to break it. In the local environment, what do we see? As the velocity gets up to magnitudes like lead and bismuth, you're just about out of stability in this environment. If you go past bismuth, things get broken apart. Okay, so that's the velocity part. If you get up to big enough ones, if you get in a really quiet place, 100, element 100 will hold together. But there's no place quiet enough for element 101 to hold together. Okay, it's fundamentally unstable and will come apart. But 100 and below are inherently stable. They're all stable in a calm environment, but the hotter subelectronically the environment gets, the bigger ones start to come apart. In this environment, it's all the way down. I mean, bismuth is basically stable. I mean, it's right on the boundary line where, it can get whacked hard enough to decay, but it's very, very rare. It's basically stable. Okay, number 83. See, so 84 to 100, it's too hot here.
Gold 82.
You know, and gold. No. Lead is 82. Gold. I can't remember off the top of my head what number gold is, but lead's 82, bismuth's 83. So that's what they mean by velocity, is getting up to those bigger, higher magnitude, you know, rotation structures. And then the certain conditions of revolution, there's also a symmetry of the structure. These motions are in a symmetry. And if that system of rotations gets too asymmetric, it will be radioactive and get itself more symmetric. It'll do beta decay, technically, is what it'll do. You know, the main thing that those bigger atoms do is alpha decay, try to get themselves to be a smaller structure. The beta decay is just sort of a readjustment. It's like the football is not stable. Let's make it more basketball-like, right? Let's make it more symmetric, and then it's stable. And that beta decay is an adjustment thing. Right, to the, you know, it's basically staying the same mass, but it's just rearranging its parts so that it's more symmetric. And so that's what they mean by revolution there. The difference between velocity and revolution is, you know, is the system of revolution symmetric? You know, if it's too asymmetric, it's going to be radioactive. If the velocities are too great in the particular environment, it's going to be radioactive. And temperature, you know, if it's too hot, things are going to be radioactive. Things are going to fall apart. Okay, so that's what they're talking about there. And then they just throw in temperature, energy currents, distance, and the presence of living force organizers and the power directors also have a bearing on all transmutation phenomena of energy and matter. You know, there's all these various issues, environmental issues, including there could be beings that can't be neglected. And definitely with the life carriers managing the evolution of life on this planet with the aid of the master physical controllers, that mention of power directors, power beings here, is very important. The energy transformers are working with the life carriers, okay, and there are consequences to radioactivity because of that. That's one of the things that we're unpacking in the Purposeful History of Life presentation. So I'm not going to get into all the physics details here, but that's a very important sentence in the book. It's the only spot that they give you, that little reminder that there's going to be a relationship between radioactivity and the actions of power beings.
Code
79. What was that?
Gold is 79.
Oh, gold. Okay. All right. Let's get some more here.
The increase of mass in matter is equal to the increase of energy divided by the square of the velocity of light. In a dynamic sense, the work which resting matter can perform is equal to the energy expended in bringing its parts together from paradise, minus the resistance of the forces overcome in transit and the attraction exerted by the parts of matter on one another.
Okay, there's a lot of physics here that we're not going to get into, but let me just give you a little taste of it. The first thing is, one thing is the revelators are reworking these sentences from Swan. You know, from the Architecture of the Universe paper, like I mentioned, you know, one of the source works. Like, for instance, Swan says, the increase of mass is equal. Here they see the increase of mass in matter. They tweak it like that, right? You know, there's a certain amount of mass-like motion in matter. Yeah, that's why they're saying it that way. Rather than just this mystery of mass. Right, and then the way it's said there, rather than saying E equals mc squared, you know, see how they're doing? They're doing m equals E over c squared. See how that, you know, mass is equal to energy divided by the square of the velocity of light. Right, thinking about that mass as being some kind of an energy, and it has the speed of light squared. It has a two-dimensional, it's not c to the first power, speed of light to the first power, speed of light to the third power, it's speed of light to the second power. Remember how I was telling you, there's a fundamental two-dimensionalness related to mass? That's why it's c squared. And that little, tease you with that little thought. And then the rest of it, in current physics, they're referring to, and then they've really reworked the way that's stated from what's in Swan. Swan is referring to the concept of binding energy. There's a certain amount of energy, involved with the binding of a structure. And they're modifying that, upstepping our billiard ball idea of binding energy. I mean, obviously, Swan wouldn't have said something about bringing the parts together from paradise. The billiard balls in the normal picture are coming in from an infinite distance. So infinite distance has become paradise. Remember what we talked about as we started this paper, right? You're setting up the foundation. The outward scalar motion is that differential between the modified space potency and the absoluteness of the aisle. You're setting up this contrast from the aisle. You initially have that foundational contrast of the force charge of space, and then going to an ultimaton is an even further contrast. That's what they're talking about, differentiating things from paradise. Okay? And that has two parts instead of the one part that current science thinks. Current science thinks about something like the attraction exerted by the parts of matter on one another in the binding energy, an internal binding, but they threw in another thing, what you might call an external binding energy. Minus the resistance of the forces overcome in transit, not just minus the attraction exerted, but minus two things. Space is not empty. All this is happening at least in the force charge presence, coupled to the force charge. It's also happening in all of this sub-electronic activity. And that's going to be the integrity of the atom, is predicated on that sub-electronic phenomenon. Right. So that's one thing that current science doesn't appreciate, is that there is, you have to, if you're going to assemble something, as I'm assembling it, I'm generating waves in the force charge. I'm going to have to do enough work to generate those waves in the force charge, as well as do any work, in terms of internal phenomenon. It's coupled to the environment as well as the internal coupling. No current scientist would approve of this sort of stuff, basically. So that's, without getting into any further details, that's what they're trying to give you a new starting point for thinking about the binding energy, what holds things together, and not thinking of billiard balls in a vacuum, but you've got motions that are coupled to other motions and motions that are coupled to the background motions. There's an internal and an external aspect of this. It's a very complicated phenomenon. The fact that, current science doesn't have any of that sub-electronic stuff, like when they think about absolute zero, and they try to rationalize phenomena where there seems to be activity, even though there should be just absolute zero, quote unquote, then they have to dream up magical things like vacuum fluctuations and stuff like this, that nothing can fluctuate, and that gives you activity. It's like, well, how about if you actually have a something that gives you the activity? No, we can't see anything, so there can't be a something. But we can imagine that nothing is active. Yeah, you could, but that's illogical. Okay, so that's the sort of stuff they do to rationalize things like radioactivity and stuff like that. They make nothing do something instead of having something doing something. Okay?
The existence of pre-electronic forms of matter is indicated by the two atomic weights of lead. The lead of original formation weighs slightly more than that produced through uranium disintegration by way of radium emanations. And this difference in atomic weight represents the actual loss of energy in the atomic breakup.
Okay, now you've got a little bit of historical context here in talking about the radioactivity of uranium. The initial way that was talked about, and I mean, if you look it up today, you'll still see them referring to this because it's so prevalent. Before you thought about all of the different isotopes of all the different atoms, you spoke in sort of more phenomenological terms. When uranium, primary isotope of uranium, decays, as they describe it, breaks up, it goes through radium, you know, that element, followed by radon, you know, radon gas, which was initially called a radium emanation, you know, because, you know, it's a gas and it would escape, emanate. You know, so that they're talking about that basic decay chain that goes, you know, that goes from uranium-238, you know, that has a mass number of 238, and that decays down to an isotope of lead that's lighter than the average weight of lead. There's several stable isotopes of lead, and they're just pointing out that decays down, you know, lighter than the mean weight. And they're saying that represents the actual loss of energy in the atomic breakup, which is kind of a mysterious thing to say. Without going into any details, what they're trying to point out is, notice the thing that's very non-expected from a current scientific perspective in there. When they say the lead of original formation, okay, what were we just reading? Okay, you have an environmental phenomenon that builds up from smaller and smaller things until you build up to lead and bigger things. And they're pointing out, remember we just mentioned how the environment is involved. You can't just think of these things as isolated things in a vacuum. Okay, and so the lead in our environment here is in equilibrium with the environment. It isn't just this thing in and of itself in a vacuum. It's a combination of a thing and an environment. Okay? And there's a certain weight of lead that's in equilibrium with this environment. If you break up your uranium-238 into until it comes down and finds a stable spot in lead, see, it's lighter than what's in equilibrium in the environment. See, it's fundamentally telling you that it doesn't represent the kind of lead that you would get in a natural developmental process in this environment. It's been injected, you know, as a non sequitur into this environment. It's lighter than it would be if it was a lead that had come up from the bottom, smaller things building into bigger things. Okay. Now, just quickly about, you know, you were saying the environment can vary. And so what isotopes are stable and what aren't varies with the environment. And to really explain that, we'd have to get into physics, and we don't want to do that. But just another aspect of how the environment is a part of this. You know, we think of a particular isotope as just absolutely stable or unstable. No, it's stable or unstable relative to the environment. And something that's stable here will not be stable somewhere else. And not just because it's big and it's hotter there. But even down where all you have is stable elements, where those stable ones are amidst all the different isotopes shifts with the environment. Lighter isotopes of certain elements will be stable in different environments. Heavier ones will be stable in different environments. Yeah. So you have all of this complexity. They're basically just trying to point out there, no, see, the existence of pre-electronic forms.
Different different environments, could be even different planets, you mean, or different...
Different solar systems, different stars are in different environments, whatnot. Yeah.
Not necessarily moving it from the South Pole to the North
Pole. No. We're in one environment here. Yeah, pretty much. But notice the existence of pre-electronic forms. This is where they definitively are telling you. Radioactivity is a phenomenon that's caused by sub-electronic activity. Or if you're thinking in a developmental sense, it's pre-electronic. Yeah, but just an existential sense, it's sub-electronic. Right? It's that sub-electronic activity that's disrupting the atom. Okay? So the one thing that they're just saying there is the very fact that you have that radioactivity and end up with, lead isotopes that are lighter than the norm, is because there's this sub-electronic activity. But then also, to appreciate that that lead didn't develop in harmony with the environment, with all of that sub-electronic activity. And so that's another thing why the existence of pre-electronic forms is indicated by that. Think of it, as a system. It's not just an atom. It's an atom and an environment. The two go hand in hand. There is no separation between the two of them. You can't understand the environment without the things and the particles, and you can't understand the particles without the environment. It's a cosmic system. The whole thing works together. All right. Keep going here.
The relative integrity of matter is assured by the fact that energy can be absorbed or released only in those exact amounts which Urantia scientists have designated quanta. This wise provision in the material realm serves to maintain the universes as going concerns.
Yeah, people love to remember the going concerns line here. So what keeps everything as a going concern? If you didn't have quantization, if you didn't have, it can be this and that and nothing in between, it's discrete. If everything was continuous, the universe couldn't be stable, right? If a butterfly, on a remote world could flap its wings and part of my molecular structure would chip off, nothing could be stable, right? There has to be a minimum where you can whack and whack and whack, but it doesn't get up to a whack size of one, and so nothing breaks off. Right, it has to get up to that first, smallest nugget. If it's not hitting it that hard, it's not going to break. I mean, all of the stable atoms in this room are being whacked, but not hard enough that they can break, because of quantization. Things are discrete. It's below the threshold, so it doesn't fall apart. Now, if things weren't quantized, if there wasn't discreteness, if everything was literally continuous, every little jiggle would chip a little bit of that table off, and it would just slowly evaporate. Your body would evaporate. There couldn't be bodies. There couldn't be anything stable. It couldn't be going concerns. There wasn't quantization. The discovery of quantization in the beginning part of the 20th century was very important. That's a very fundamental part of reality. But just because there's quantization doesn't mean there has to be so-called quantum mechanics. Things are quantized, but they're not rationalized by that magical scheme. Okay? And they have to be quantized. Everything is quantized. Everything is individuated. It's the expression of individuality, after all, not unity. So that's a very important part of physics. The revelation was given to us when we discovered that, because now we had something that we could, that they could reveal upon and within. Before we knew that things were quantized, we didn't know enough for them to reveal the truth about the physical world. We get into some of the profound consequences of quantization to solving long-standing riddles in philosophy, when we do Reawakening Philosophy 1, for instance. That's an important thing. You know, automatons are little quanta. You know, that's the smallest quantum of motion, materialized motion. Okay, you know, why are they called quanta? Yeah, you know, because of the second word in the next paragraph here.
The quantity of energy taken in or given out when electronic or other positions are shifted is always a quantum or some multiple thereof. But the vibratory or wave-like behavior of such units of energy is wholly determined by the dimensions of the material structures concerned. Such wave-like energy ripples are 860 times the diameters of the automatons, electrons, atoms, or other units thus performing. The never-ending confusion attending the observation of the wave mechanics of quantum behavior is due to the superimposition of energy waves. Two crests can combine to make a double height crest, while a crest and a trough may combine, thus producing mutual cancellation.
Okay, so that paragraph's transitioning to the next section. They were going to talk about waves and the force charge. Okay, and they're reminding you, just like we've observed, all these, you know, microscopic phenomena are quantized, but we're very confused about the distinction between the materializations and the waves and the force charge. The materializations are coupled to the force charge, so they interact with each other dynamically. Any changes in a materialization, since it's coupled to the force charge, will produce waves in the force charge. It'll produce technically, you notice it's such wave-like energy ripples. I've already mentioned that. You know, it makes a ripple, you know, in the immediacy of the materialization. It makes a ripple in the force charge, but the force charge is an outward scalar motion at the speed of light, and so that ripple goes flying off, you know. And so if it's a oscillating influence, it's going to make an oscillating ripple, you know, and you'll have a chain of ripples moving out like a wave in the force charge. Okay? But it's actually the force charge that's moving, not the wave. Now, you don't have a static medium with waves moving through it. You have a moving medium, you know, with a ripple on it. Okay, so that's why it's wave-like instead of literally waves. All right, and, you know, waves, you know waves can superimpose and cancel. Everyone is, you know, if everyone's watched water waves, you know, you can watch two water waves, you know, get in sync and make a bigger wave, or, you know, get out of sync and cancel each other out and have a little bit of a placid sheet of water, right? I mean, you know, the waves and the force charge do that. You know, and quantum mechanics or wave mechanics, see, he tries to rationalize everything with waves. It tries to explain the particles with the waves. And so in order to do that, since they're not the same thing, it has to make the waves magical. In a magical medium and of a magical nature. Okay? But there are waves. But you got to keep them separate. Waves are waves and particles are particles. But it's all coupled. So besides materializations of a subelectronic nature, you've got all of the waves of a subelectronic nature that are involved. When an atom is radioactive and is coming apart, that's going to produce subelectronic waves in the force charge. They talk about that up there in the spatial environment section when they're talking about right before they implant life. They remind you of all of those subelectronic waves that are generated and have, you know, issues related to life. We won't go into that. And then the other exciting little thing there is the little tidbit of physics that they threw in there in the middle. Okay, such wave-like energy ripples are 860 times the diameters of the ultimatons, electrons, atoms, or other units thus performing. That's very important. 860, you know, just the two significant digits. They can't give you a whole bunch of them. They're just pointing to what they're talking about. That's 2 times pi times the reciprocal of the fine structure constant. Okay? Fine structure constant is a very important dimensionless constant in fundamental physics. We know it's so mysterious that it spawns, you know, religious-like fascination. You know, whole kind of cult movements, you know, about the mystery of the fine structure constant. And they're pointing out kind of why it would fascinate so like that. You know, almost like it was a religious phenomenon. We know it's some kind of a coupling related to waves, you know, what we call electromagnetic waves, what are actually waves in the force charge of space. See, they're telling you, they're giving you the information you need to begin to relate the absentite to the finite. You have a certain absentite magnitude that gives a certain diameter of a footprint in the finite. And that diameter in the scale of that footprint has a relationship, you know, precisely 2 times pi times reciprocal of the fine structure constant, which is approximately 137. The fact that it's really close to an integer has fascinated people too. It's really close to being exactly 137. See, that it's giving you the relationship between the wavelength of the wave and the size of the particle. See, it's talking, helping you to understand this relationship between the particle and the wave, and at the same time, the relationship of the absentite to the finite. So it's a very important clue. And there are shades of this thing, of this fact, in some of the physics that we already know. I can't explain any of it because it's too complicated, but I mean, there's a thing called Compton scattering, for instance, the scattering of a photon off of an electron, where you see this fine structure constant coming into play, you know, related to wavelength size. See, like you have here.
Fine structure constant. What does it mean?
I mean, it's called the fine structure constant because it's it's related to the mathematics of calculating fine structure and spectral lines. You have the coarse structure, and then you have the fine structure in them. But you know, so it was originally given that kind of prosaic name, but it's actually a very, very deep fundamental constant because it's actually a dimensionless constant. You know, it doesn't have units of meters and seconds and whatnot. It's just a number. See, so it's obviously something that everyone knows. It's something very deeply fundamental. You know, it's related to the coupling between the absentite and the finite.
Not everybody knows that.
Right, and we can't know that. That's why they can tell us it tell it to us right here. They're giving us what we need to know to finally have a proper outlet for all of our zeal related to the fine structure constant. It'll allow you to, if you want to pursue that, it'll allow you to begin to unpack the mystery of the relationship of the absentite to the finite and the relationship of particles to waves, the fundamental phenomena that currently now is shrouded in mystery and rationalized by magic. And that's a huge, huge sentence.
If there was someone who had some background in physics or had a real interest in this and wanted to get in deeper and do a deep dive into learning more about what you're alluding to, how might they do that?
Well, it's just getting deeper into it is something that I've been trying to do for years, and You know, it's going to take a lot of effort to unpack all these details. But, you know, if somewhere out there is a budding young physicist who's serious about taking his physics development, him or her, to a PhD level, only in the context of the revelation, you know, this should be very exciting. This is what you're looking for. These little clues like this are the beginnings of a new physics. They're not allowed to give you many of those sorts of very specific things like that. I mean, see, it's, you know, they can give you two significant digits even. You know, I mean, they're not even allowed to point to it so directly that they would give you, you know, 5 decimal places or something, you know. But, you know, it's a suggestion of a very definitive nature, right? You know, anyone who, you know, has ever played around with physics stuff goes, wait a minute, 860? That's 2 times pi times the fine structure constant, you know, inverse of the fine structure constant. Yeah. Right, so, all right, so anyway, we went way over there, I'm sorry. We better wrap it up here. But, so you've got a lot of kind of big picture stuff, and then they actually, those last few paragraphs, those last 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs, they actually start to get some fairly significant physics suggestion stuff. It's those paragraphs that you can use to put down your first equations and things. Start actually developing a physics and not just thinking about the philosophic context and the truth of it. All right, let's wrap it up right there.